We're starting off this season by speaking with Dr. Wayne Madison of the Zoology Department. Having just celebrated Halloween, we thought it would be appropriate to talk to someone about those creepy little creatures on everyone's mind this time of year. Yes, we're talking about spiders. And here to tell us more about Dr. Madison is Lex Stoymanoff. Hello, Lex. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Hi, Karen.
Can you tell us a bit about Dr. Madison and about the interview we're about to hear?
Well, I met with Dr. Madison in his office this week, and we had a great conversation about his work with jumping spiders. He has studied these spiders all over the world, and he's really passionate about relating these studies to evolutionary science.
Let's hear what Dr. Madison has to say.
I'm Wayne Madison. I'm a professor in zoology and botany. And I'm now also the director of a new museum that'll be coming online, the Beattie Biodiversity Museum, and we hope to have that open late spring of next year. And I've been at UBC for 6 years now.
Where were you before UBC?
Immediately before, I was at the University of Arizona, but I'm originally Canadian, and it was a long path back, but it's great to be back.
So can you tell us a bit about your research on spiders?
I work in the general field of studying evolutionary history and biodiversity, and my work on spiders is focused on one particular group of spiders. There are enough spiders to go around, so it's tough to study all of them. There are about 40,000 described species of spiders right now. The group that I work on are the jumping spiders, and that group includes about 5,000 species so far described.
Oh, wow. It's a lot.
It's a lot. And so if you think about birds, for instance, there are about 10,000 species of birds, more or less, and there are an awful lot of ornithologists out there in the world. The group of spiders that I work on has about 5,000 known, but probably another 5,000 out there not known, so it's about the same size as birds, and I can count on two hands the number of people that work very seriously on them in the world. So each of us working on them finds that we have easily enough to keep us busy.
So you must be one of the leading experts then in your field.
Yeah, it's a small pond, but I guess I can count myself as that.
So what drew you to this area of study?
Well, it actually started many, many years ago. I got into jumping spiders when I was a teenager, and I'd always been interested in nature and going outside and seeing bugs and so forth, but when I was down along the shores of Lake Ontario one day as an early teenager. A grass mat that I guess somebody had recently cut some grass floated by with a big jumping spider on it. And she looked up at me, and I was just curious and saved her from whatever fate she was about to have floating on this grass mat, and kept her for a while and just got more and more fascinated with them. The reason that she looked up at me is that the jumping spiders have excellent eyesight. And if you've ever looked at one up close, you'll see that on the front of the head are four big eyes. They've also got four smaller eyes on the top of the head. They've got eight eyes total, which most spiders have. But in the jumping spiders, the front eyes are particularly large, and they give them excellent vision so that they tend to look up at things the way we do, too. A lot of spiders don't do that. You see them bumbling around, and they can see things, but you don't really notice them paying attention to the world visually the way a jumping spider does.
I see. So if these jumping spiders have such large eyes, then they must be pretty big for us to be able to see the eyes.
As with many organisms, if you've got a microscope, you can see all sorts of things. There are a couple of species common on buildings in Vancouver. They're not particularly big. If you looked at them closely, you could see that there are these little shiny black spots in the front of the face that are the eyes, and they're bigger than normal, but it's not like they're big enough to really get an appreciation of the eyes. There are some species that are a little bit larger, that you can find in gardens and out in the wild here, that get to be about half an inch long, a little over a centimeter. And those ones are big enough to notice the eyes on. And it was one of those that I found on the grass mat many years ago.
Oh, okay. So those ones, they live here in Vancouver?
So something very close related to ones that live in Vancouver. But jumping spiders range in size from about a millimeter and a half long, up until about 20 millimeters long in body length, which if you were to imagine a 20 millimeter long spider, it's nowhere close to a big tarantula, but it's enough to notice.
So how do they jump? How are they able to jump?
So jumping spiders, I mean, you might think that the most notable characteristic of jumping spiders is their jumping ability, but in fact, it's probably better to think of the eyes as being the key. But having such good eyes, you can spot prey from a distance, and it's really handy to be able to jump then, because you can pounce on them, and in fact, they basically hunt like cats. If they spot a fly, for instance, a few centimeters away, they will turn towards it, they'll crouch down a little bit, they'll creep forward, and then they'll jump on it. And their jumps can be pretty accurate, so they'll pounce specifically on a particular region of the fly or other prey that might subdue it best. They know to come from the front for some prey and go for the back from others, for instance. But the jumping mechanism is rather peculiar because they don't have big back legs like grasshoppers. You don't see these big muscular legs. And the reason is that the muscle power for the jumping is not actually in the legs. It's in the body itself, because the muscle contraction actually just raises the blood pressure, and the blood pressure makes the legs straighten out. It's a little bit like some of those jumping frog toys where you've got a bulb that you squeeze and the little rubber tongue that's rolled up suddenly uncoils and the little frog jumps forward. Effectively, that's what these spiders do. They raise their blood pressure and the legs suddenly snap straight, which then propels them forward. So it's a hydraulic system. It's not a direct muscle action.
I see. So do these jumping spiders pose any threat to humans? Do they bite? Or?
I have been working with jumping spiders now for well over 30 years. I've been bitten twice. Both of those times were with some of the largest ones. Your average jumping spider is too small to actually even pierce your skin. So most jumping spiders are no harm just because they couldn't actually do anything if they tried. The very largest ones, though, can pierce skin. Both of those times, for me, there was certainly a momentary pain that suggested that there was some sort of venom working. Almost all spiders have venom of some sort, but the venom, in almost all cases, has been naturally selected for action against insects, and so it's strong enough to have an effect on an insect. But in only very few cases in spiders does it actually have much of an effect on larger animals like ourselves. So for me, the pain was there, not very strong, and it went away in about 5 or 10 minutes. So it was much milder than a typical bee sting. The only danger likely to exist with a jumping spider bite is due to some sort of allergic reaction, which of course could happen with just about anything like that, any sort of bite or sting from any animal.
Of course. So have you ever had any frightening experiences with spiders? Not necessarily the jumping variety, but...
Well, it might actually be worthwhile just to comment on frightening spiders in general and why people react the way they do. I think I actually, there are some spiders that give me the willies, I've got to say. There are some, but not among the jumping spiders. There are some large ones that run around, and I don't feel completely comfortable in having them walk on me. And I know it's somewhat irrational, but I can sort of appreciate some of the reaction that people have. But I think with the jumping spiders, what makes them not nearly so threatening is partly this issue of their use of vision, that when you watch a jumping spider, you feel as if you understand what it's going to do next, because it's reacting to the world in a similar way to most of us, in that they look up, they notice things, and so forth. So there's a little bit of predictability suddenly that comes in with a jumping spider that most spiders don't have. To me, when I see most spiders running around, I have no clue what it's thinking. I have no clue what it's going to do next. It, of course, is seeing the world primarily in terms of touch and odors with a bit of vision thrown in. And so they inhabit a world so unlike ours that you just don't know what they're going to do next. Most of them are pretty harmless, but you don't want to get bitten even if they're not going to have any sort of venom. I've never had an experience with a non-jumping spider that has really freaked me out, but I've seen plenty of them, and I'm curious about other spiders, but if they're large and long-legged, I tend not to spend a lot of time with them walking on my hands.
Understandable. So do you think that this unpredictability is part of the reason why so many people have such severe fears of spiders?
Could be, but it's probably not a sufficient explanation, because there are all sorts of other things in the world that are a bit unpredictable. You know, a fruit fly is unpredictable, and people don't freak out about those. So I don't know. I don't know what the story is there as to why people have such a strong reaction about spiders.
You're listening to an interview with Professor Wayne Madison on Prof Talk here on CITR 101.9 FM. We'll be right back.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro. And I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM. Welcome back to Prof Talk. If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with zoology professor Dr. Wayne Madison about his research on jumping spiders.
Well, I know your specialty is in the jumping spiders, but I had a couple of friends who were like, oh, you're interviewing a spider prof. Ask him how we can identify spiders that are dangerous versus spiders that wouldn't be.
Well, the good news there is that in most parts of the world, it's not like you have to memorize all the ones that are safe. You mostly just have to memorize the ones that are dangerous, because there are far fewer that are dangerous than are safe. So in most parts of the world, if you get to know more or less what a black widow looks like, you get to know more or less what a recluse spider looks, a brown spider looks like, and a few others like that, you end up pretty much knowing what you should be careful with. There are widow spiders here in Canada. You can find them, for instance, on some of the beaches, say in around southern coast of BC. And, you know, the great thing about the web nowadays, if you just do an image search on Google for black widow or Latrodectus or brown spider, you'll see all sorts of examples of what they look like.
So those are the ones to look out for, brown recluse?
In Canada, it's really just it's almost certainly the only ones to really worry about are the widow spiders. There have been reports of the hobo spiders, Tegenaria, being an issue. There was fear for a while that they might they might be poisonous in some regards, but it's seeming more and more likely that those concerns were not grounded. So right now, I think the major things to worry about in Canada, they're not things that people encounter very often. So.
Right. So you've studied here in BC, I'm assuming. Where else have you gone to study spiders in the field?
Well, in the last couple of years, I've done quite a bit of traveling in order to get a broad sample of biodiversity of jumping spiders to understand the big picture of the evolutionary history of this group. And so that's required going to a number of different continents. I've been to South America, to Ecuador, to Southeast Asia, to Malaysia and Singapore, to Papua New Guinea, to Africa, namely Gabon, and recently to the Dominican Republic and the Caribbean. So those are pretty spectacular areas to go visit. Sometimes the logistics and the safety weren't as great as you might hope, but we managed to get what we went for and got back safely, and it's been really productive in terms of pushing forward our knowledge of the evolutionary history and biodiversity of this group.
I see. So what's been the most significant development in your research?
In terms of the spiders, the biggest thing that we've done is understand much more clearly the basic groups into which jumping spiders fall in terms of their evolutionary relationships. And another way to say that is that we've come to understand the early diversification of the group much better. So if you can imagine 5,000 species trying to understand how they're all related to one another, prior to about 10 years ago, we really didn't have very much clue as to how they were related. It turns out that when people did early work on this group, they did it just as they do with many, by looking at the various structures that their bodies have. And in some groups of organisms, this has worked very well, that the similarities and differences among structures have really retained a strong signal of evolutionary relationships. In this particular group, some of the key structures that people look at are rather simple, so there's not enough variation to really get a good idea. And so our understanding from those structures of the evolutionary relationships was not very detailed, but with molecular techniques that we've been able to apply to these fresh specimens that we've collected, we've really been able to make significant progress in understanding what the major groups are. And so we're hoping that with that, we'll be able to apply this knowledge of evolutionary history to understand things like the evolution of chromosomes in the group, the evolution of behaviors in the group. And so we've managed to do that much better in the last little while. Perhaps the most significant discovery in terms of a single moment, which what I've just described, of course, you can imagine is built up over years, but a single moment was going to the field in Papua New Guinea recently and finding some lineages of jumping spiders that had never been found before that split off from the other jumping spiders fairly early in their evolutionary history. So it amounts to finding something rather different from what we had seen before. And when I was in the field and realized what I had found, that was probably the most precious moment over the last couple of years regarding jumping spider biodiversity.
So you've discovered several species of new spiders, like new to science. Mm-hmm. How does that feel to have accomplished that?
Well, you know, it's when I was first starting out many years ago, it was really exciting. But then when you start to discover how many people have worked on this group, how many species there are, and how much there is left to know, it's actually quite easy to find species new to science in this group, it turns out. In fact, in Canada right now, what we tend to have is we tend to have a backlog of ones that we know we've discovered but haven't yet got around to publishing because there are so many things to do. So in Canada right now, there are at least two species that are undescribed that we know about but have yet to be formally described. The closer you get to the tropics, the more and more there are. So simply finding a new species is something that we don't get too excited about right now, but if we find something that's quite different from whatever we found before, so it's a whole new lineage, then that starts to get much more exciting, and that's where the story of Papua New Guinea comes in. And that just feels amazing, because it's like you're suddenly opening up a new world. I suppose it would be a little bit like when you are playing a video game and you suddenly arrive at a new level that you'd never seen before, and you just start wondering, what could there be there? Like, what am I going to discover? And when you find a completely new lineage of organisms, you wonder, well, what's it going to be like? You know, we don't know anything about its behavior. We don't know anything about all sorts of things about it. And suddenly it's a new world that's opened up to you.
That's a good analogy. Can you maybe explain a bit about how studying spiders helps you connect your research to the broader study of evolution?
Well, in the last 20 or 30 years, evolutionary biology has started to make heavier and heavier use of genetic history as a key piece of background information for understanding the processes of evolution, so how evolution works in terms of natural selection and ecological forces and developmental constraints and so forth. So the knowledge of that evolutionary history becomes key. And by studying jumping spiders and understanding their evolutionary history, it's really done two things for me. One is that it's helped me understand how we put together evolutionary histories. And there's another side to my research that's theoretical, where I try to understand what methods we use that can be applied to spiders or anything else to understand evolutionary histories and what they tell us about evolution. And so working on the spiders is giving me practice being doing it myself, as opposed to just being a theoretician and understanding how in practice we can take these genetic histories and apply them to understand evolutionary process. But the other thing with the jumping spiders is that right now we are looking to understand how their evolutionary radiations on these different continents happened, and we see that as being probably insightful for the general processes that all organisms might go through in radiating ecologically. And the reason that the jumping spiders look like a good study system for this concerns the fact that they seem to have radiated in different continents to a certain extent in isolation. So the group of jumping spiders that is the largest group in South America turns out to be mostly endemic to the New World, to the Americas, whereas the group of jumping spiders that commonest in the African tropical forests is only in Africa, for instance. And so in both cases, and you see similar patterns in Southeast Asia and Australasia and so forth, you go to an area and you see a certain spectrum of jumping spiders. You see long, thin ones that live on leaves of trees. You see flat, brown ones that live against tree bark. You see brown, robust ones that live on the ground. And this pattern is repeated in different continents. And yet, these radiations, from a genetic and evolutionary point of view, are independent. So one of the questions is, if you were to start off, and this is a general question for evolutionary biology, if you were to start off an ecosystem from scratch and do it again, would it evolve in the same way? If you were to start a group and evolve it from scratch, would it evolve in the same way? So is evolution to some extent repeatable? Do things happen in a predictable way in the end? Or is every instance completely novel and unlike every other instance? And the fact that with these jumping spiders we have these replicate radiations on these different continents actually gives us a chance to look at that. Do each of these radiations seem to have happened in a similar way? And if so, what does that mean? And the reason that this works with the jumping spiders is that it seems that they are quite young. They've evolved only in the last 50 million years or so, which has given them a chance to evolve each in isolation since the continents were already split apart. When they arrived at continents, a particular continent, they were pretty much isolated there in their subsequent evolution. So the fact that we get these replicate cases of evolutionary radiations gives us an opportunity to see what happens in general, and that could be informative not just of how jumping spiders evolve, but in general how ecological communities are put together in evolutionary time.
Cool.
But that project is just getting started, because the first step was to understand the basic evolutionary history of the group in terms of who's related to whom, what the genetic history is, and now we can go out and look at the connection to ecology.
Oh, wow. So that's big.
Yeah.
After this, do you have any upcoming trips for field work? Or?
Not at the moment. There's some places high on my list of where I'd like to go, but the logistics haven't been worked out. I'd love to visit Brazil. I'd love to visit Madagascar, for instance, but haven't worked out the logistics yet.
You've been listening to Prof Talk and an interview with Professor Wayne Madison, who studies jumping spiders here at UBC.
This is my life. I wake up in the morning, I eat, I sleep, I shit.
Breakfast with the Browns.
Sure, whatever it is, but I never shut it off for 5 minutes.
I can't wait to impress my friends with my astounding knowledge of cool.
Join your favorite brownsters and tune in and listen to the best selection of down-tempo electropop lounge core.
Strictly Squaresville.
Remember, subtle, basic, brown.
Breakfast with the Browns
on CITR 101.9 FM every Monday morning
from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m.
The older I get, the more life starts to make sense and the less I care.
Now we're riding the rainbow, the clouds lift, and we're making it like young. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville, and we're making it like you. Now we're riding the rainbow to Cloudsville.
Welcome back to Prof Talk. This year on the show, we've decided to have a little fun with our professors. At the end of each interview, we're going to ask a series of rapid-fire, nonsensical, just-for-fun questions. The idea here is to get to know a bit about our professors outside of their research expertise. Let's have a listen now to Dr. Madison's rapid-fire responses.
Okay, brown bread or white bread?
See, the problem is you ask the professors and they're going to always say, it depends, right? It's sort of one of, part of our nature, right? So it depends upon whether I'm feeling, whether the little good angel that sits on my shoulder is talking or whether the bad angel that sits on my shoulder is talking at that point. So I'm going to say both, it turns out, at different times.
All right, Mac or PC?
Mac.
Car or bike?
I like to ride my bike as often as I can into work, but obviously there are lots of times when a car is the only way to go. So,
coffee or tea?
Tea.
Phone or email?
If it's to a friend, phone. If it's not, email.
Mountain or ocean?
Mountain.
Pen or pencil?
Pencil.
Chocolate or vanilla?
Oh, chocolate.
Khaki or denim?
Denim.
Digital clock or analog?
Probably analog.
All right, that's all I got.
Yeah, professors seem to have a little trouble answering anything really rapidly.
You're right, it's not really in their nature to answer either-or questions, I suppose. But Dr. Madison did a good job. Thanks for being a good sport, Dr. Madison. So once again, you're here listening to Prof Talk on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Lex, thanks so much for being with us today and, of course, for sharing your interview with Dr. Madison.
No problem. It was awesome meeting Dr. Madison, and I definitely learned a lot of new things about spiders.
I think we all did. Thanks again.
Sure thing.
Well, that's it for Prof Talk this week. A big thank you goes out to Lex Stoymanoff and Dr. Wayne Madison for being on the show today. And of course, thank you to all of you for joining us on Prof Talk this morning. We'll be back again next Monday morning, and if you've got any questions or comments about the show, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us off an email at proftalk@gmail.com. Also, a podcast of today's show will be available online at citr.ca. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back again next week. So long.
Wake up, the sun is out, singing, I know, the good times are coming our way, I know, you were afraid of me, and would not face the world, so open your eyes, and see, I'm singing,